Welcome to our podcast, Psychiatric Services, From Pages to Practice. In this podcast, we highlight new research or columns published this month in the journal Psychiatric Services. I'm Lisa Dixon, editor of Psychiatric Services, and I'm here with podcast editor and my co-host, Josh Berezin. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Lisa. Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. It is 2019. It's been 2019 for several days already.
Yes, we're well on our way.
Today, we're going to talk about three articles from the journal that have recently been published online. We'll take an inside look at benzodiazepine use in the United States. Then we're going to look at parenting and the role of child protective services among people with SMI. And finally, we're going to close with a very exciting randomized trial about self-directed care. Let's get started.
Sounds good. First up, we have Donovan Mouse and colleagues on benzodiazepine use and misuse among adults in the United States. So a huge topic, and another one of those things that comes up literally on a daily, if not multiple times a day basis for clinicians in practice. And one of the reasons that it's coming up so much is because there's been a big increase in use from over the past 20 years in both benzodiazepine use and also overdoses during the past 20, 25 years. Just to put some numbers on that, there's been a 50% increase in benzodiazepine use from 96 to 2013, and a fivefold increase in benzo-related overdoses in that same time period. And, you know, one of the things that we always think about clinically with benzodiazepines is that as people get older, the risks associated with them with falls and cognitive issues increases.
Yeah, and there's been, I think, increasing awareness and attention to that.
Right. And we also always think about, are these drugs going to be diverted or misused in a way? So it's sort of surprising that we don't have very much research that's kind of putting all of those together about finding out how benzodiazepine use and misuse changes over the lifespan and what characteristics are associated with those.
And this study begins to answer some of these questions.
Yeah, and so this is using a national survey, the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, which is sponsored by SAMHSA and interviews people from all 50 states. So the interesting thing is that it was redesigned in 2015 to collect more detailed data about prescription drug use and misuse. Mm-hmm. So you're taking the survey and you respond that you've taken some class of prescription drugs. Then it really drills down, I guess, more than it used to, about if you've used them without a prescription, in greater amount, more frequently, for a longer duration, and why you misused the drugs, and also where you got it from.
Yeah, so that actually raises the point that I want to emphasize is, how do they define misuse in this study? And misuse is defined as any use a doctor did not direct.
So all those categories would fit into benzodiazepine misuse. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that really stood out about the results, just kind of...
Oh, wait, no, we still have to talk about when the study was done. So the study looked at 2 years of data. Right?
From 2015, 2016, mm-hmm. and people who are 18 or older. Mm-hmm. I was just so excited to
dive into the results that I missed a few of. I'm always a drag.
Yeah. No. So the results did kind of pop out to me that 12.6% of U.S. adults have used a benzodiazepine within the past year.
So that's more than 1 in 10 people.
25 million mm-hmm. people across mm-hmm. the United States. So that's a big number, I think more than I would have guessed.
Yeah.
So 12.6% of U.S. adults have used a benzodiazepine. About 2.2% of that represents misuse.
Yeah.
And like we mentioned, one of the real reasons for the study is to see how use and misuse changes across the lifespan. So the trends, I think, to keep in mind are that the prevalence of prescription use of benzodiazepines increases with age. So the older you get, the more likely you are to have been prescribed a benzodiazepine. Misuse follows the opposite trajectory. So the younger you are, the more likely you are to misuse a benzodiazepine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just to put some numbers behind that, overall, about 10% of 18 to 25-year-olds were laughing because we've been struggling with Lisa's dog, who
He needs a benzo.
He needs a benzo. It seems like he's self-soothed though for now. But if you hear a little bit of scratching, I think we could go on. So again, just to put some numbers to those trends, about 10% of 18 to 25 year olds use the benzo within the past year. That represents all use. About half of that is prescription use, and about half of that represents misuse.
Mm-hmm.
So on the other hand, on the other end of the age spectrum, overall benzo use topped out at about 14% of 50 to 64-year-olds, but the vast majority of this is prescription, and only about 1% of that represents misuse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and another kind of interesting point is that actually the maximum amount of overall use was in the age group from 50 to 64, and the 65 and overs have a slightly lower use overall. So we're not, the maximum use now is in the group of 50 to 64 year olds.
Yeah, right. So one of the things that won't surprise people is that there's, you know, these things are related, but I think this study finds, one of their findings is kind of more nuanced and surprising. So they drilled down and looked at how opioid use was associated with benzodiazepine use and misuse. So here's the interesting part. If you reported taking opioids as prescribed, you actually have a lower rate of benzodiazepine misuse. But if you report misusing, abusing, or being dependent on opioids and stimulants, those people have the highest rates of benzodiazepine misuse.
So if you're misusing one, unfortunately, you're more likely to misuse the other.
But I think also the implication is that if you're using one appropriately,
yeah,
then you may be using
the other appropriately.
Yeah. And I think one of the other things that they drill down on in the paper is, which I think is important, is why people reported misusing benzodiazepines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the most common reason that they found was to relax or relieve tension, followed by help with sleep.
You know, suggesting that real issues or subjective problems are maybe driving this misuse, which is important as we start to think about how we need to address this situation. And they also reported that older individuals were more likely to report use to sleep and less likely to report use to get high, which again is not surprising.
Yeah, but it's an interesting, I think one of the things that's helpful about their methods and splitting it up between age cohorts is it kind of highlights that different populations might need different things. I mean, one of their ideas about why misuse is so high in younger populations is that there's not adequate access to treatment for things like anxiety and insomnia.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also an interesting time to be prescribing benzodiazepines. I think we're all really very aware now about our medicine's own role in the opioid overprescribing and creating an epidemic of opioid overuse, misuse, overdose.
And death.
Deaths.
Yeah.
So I think it's a complicated question about what you should actually do in each of these individual clinical situations.
Right, right. I think this paper also made me think about the whole issue of people getting medications or misusing medications by getting the meds from friends or family, and made me think about the fact that I don't necessarily inquire about that or reflect on that or consider that in my own prescribing practice.
Yeah, I had not until a patient reported that their family member was taking their benzodiazepine.
Right.
And so I've been thinking about it since then.
Yeah. Well, it really underscores the reality that when we're treating a patient, we're not just necessarily treating that patient. We're treating or interacting with or influencing that person's whole social context. And we need to remember that.
Yeah, hopefully we're thinking that way. And maybe if we do, then benzodiazepine misuse would go down.
Yeah. But I mean, we also need to remember, I think a really key message of this paper is that we need to ask ourselves why this is happening. And if people are taking increased medication because of insomnia, we need to deal with the insomnia. We need to try to help them identify strategies so that they don't end up misusing a prescribed agent.
Right. So it's really suggesting good clinical care.
Yeah, how about that?
Next up, we have Katie Kaplan and colleagues on child protective service disparities and serious mental illnesses, results from a national survey. So again, a really important and I think understudied and underemphasized topic, parents with serious mental illness. Mm-hmm. And the article is pointing out that there's not much recent research, but is in the context of an older body of research that shows increased rates of child protective services involvement and taking kids from the homes of people with serious mental illness. Mm-hmm. So really interesting questions that they're asking. The first is just to see the prevalence of parenting with a serious mental illness. Like how many parents have a serious mental illness?
Yeah. Or what proportion of people with serious mental illness are parents?
Right. And then to see if those parents with a serious mental illness have more involvement with child protective services and also whether or not that involvement is more intensive. Mm-hmm. So to look at that question, they're using a privately funded national health survey called Pulse. And this uses cell, landline, and online questions to survey about 7,400 people a month.
Yeah, so that's how they enlist people in the survey via two telephone modes, landlines and cell phones, and also via computer. So they're really trying to get, you know, we all know, I mean, I don't even have a landline anymore. So the point is that is making the sample representative.
Yes, and I think like everybody, you know, deleting any incoming call that I don't know about because it's generally people asking me for money. But this is not asking you for money. Right. It is asking you for valuable information for psychiatric epidemiology. So they end up with a representative sample in terms of geography, race, ethnicity, income, marital status, employment, education, the whole shebang. And so it's kind of an interesting survey because you can basically pay them to include more and different questions in their kind of monthly round of surveying. What they're asking specifically is, first of all, if the respondent has a lifetime history of serious mental illness. And they're also asking about if you have children. Mm-hmm. And then they're also asking, if you say yes to that, if child protective services has been involved. And they have a set of questions that's really determining the extent of involvement with CPS from
And of course, I insist on being more precise about that. So they ask, has CPS ever contacted you with concerns about your parenting of your children? And then if so, the three things that they ask about are, did you get in-home services? Did you get out-of-home services? Or did any contact with CPS result in a change of living environment? Okay.
So just a word about their sample as well. Lisa's smiling because because we're going to be very detail-oriented on this.
Yeah, so they took the survey that went from September 2014 to December 2015, and of the 42,000-some-odd respondents, 2,456 had a serious mental illness, and that represents their SMI sample, 2,456 people.
Right, and so it's obviously easier to get a non-SMI sample, so they just looked at 1 month of survey data, and they got 3,765 people without an SMI. Okay, I think one of their just baseline facts is one of the key take-homes of the article, actually, that the percentage of people reporting being parents, which is about 70%, was the same between people with and without serious mental illness.
Yeah.
So just that, I think, is something that I think, you know, addresses some maybe misperceptions about people with SMI or stigma or bias. Mm-hmm.
The same proportion of individuals reporting being parents.
Right. And so now just to fill in a couple of numbers about their questions about CPS involvement. So now we're thinking about the group that has children. Mm-hmm. 36% of people with serious mental illness and children reported contact with child protective services. That's compared to just 5% in non-serious mental illness population.
36% to 5%.
So a huge difference. And then when they're drilling down within those people who've had some sort of contact. They're finding similar differences in the level of services. So just to take one example, for people with SMI, that contact resulted in a change of living arrangements for 75% of those people. And that's compared to 23% for parents without SMI.
Yeah.
And so those differences persist when you control for race and gender. Mm-hmm. And then the other kind of very interesting finding that they discovered was that there was a difference between mothers and fathers in terms of CPS involvement. Mm-hmm. Among parents with SMI, fathers were more likely than mothers to have CPS involvement. Mm-hmm. And when they're looking at the whole sample and those with serious mental illness, fathers are more likely than mothers to have a change in living arrangement.
Right.
So it suggests that fathers have more involvement of CPS and also more intensive services from mm-hmm. CPS once mm-hmm. they get them.
Mm-hmm. So you look at these data and it's very troubling.
Mm.
I know that when I first read it, I just thought, oh my gosh, like what can we say about this? How do we understand this? And of course, one just, you know, very important thing to begin with as you think about these data and which are reflected in the discussion is that it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, that all of these people with serious mental illness are quote unquote bad parents, mm-hmm. that we need to actually understand what may be going on here.
Well, I mean, they're pointing to a couple different potential reasons. Mm-hmm. One is that serious mental illness travels with a number of other things that can increase CPS involvement, like poverty, violence, and multiple other social determinants
yes.
of mental health. But I think what you're getting at is also just the tremendous stigma and bias that people with serious mental illness encounter, both in the broader system, but within the Child Protective Services system as well.
Right. So those are really two very important issues. One is the fact that, again, as you say, mental illness travels with social determinants that may relate to the social CPS involvement and stigma.
Right. And, you know, one of the really interesting things in their discussion is that they point to a number of laws that are still on the books that make it easier to terminate the right, terminate parental rights based on the presence of a mental illness. Mm-hmm. You know, I had just seen the Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the basis of sex movie and, mm-hmm. you know, I was imagining marching up the steps of the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
But there are, you know, legal barriers as well, or structural legal reasons why some of this is happening as well.
I mean, it's discrimination that needs to be acknowledged. At the same time, parenting is very difficult. And it's very reasonable to assume, you know, any number of health challenges may make it more difficult to parent.
Right.
And so we can't just attribute this issue or this phenomenon to stigma and social determinants. And I think at the end of this article, and even as we were sort of creating a tweet about it, I mean, this really demands that we understand why. Because, you know, parenting can be an incredibly wonderful part of life. And they talk about in the paper that it's normalizing, it's gratifying. I mean, raising children and having a family is you know, if what we all want in life is love, as to quote Larry Davidson, then having a family is you know, can be very, very, and having children can be very essential to that. And also losing a child, you know, losing custody of a child can be, you know, extremely traumatizing. So all of this suggests that we need, and as Joanne Nicholson says, it takes a village. And what we need to really do is to try to understand this and then also to support people in their efforts. And I think, you know, there's now more and more, I think, programs to, again, provide assistance to people with serious mental illnesses so that they can parent and have a family and they can parent effectively.
Next up, we have Judith Cook and colleagues on mental health self-directed care financing, efficacy in improving outcomes and controlling costs for adults with serious mental illness.
And I just want to say, Josh, I'm really excited about this article.
I think we're both excited about this article.
Yeah. I'm excited about most RCTs, but like this one.
Yes,
really,
you love all of your children in psychiatric services. You don't play favorites, but once in a while, one of your children does exceptionally well,
and you
want to make sure you point out. But no, we both think that this is a really important study, not just because of the topic, but we think it has the potential to really inform policy in kind of a big way. All right, so what are we talking about here? Self-directed care, for those of you who haven't heard about it, is a concept that's first developed in the physical and developmental disability world and has a little bit of preliminary evidence for SMI participants. So I think the basic idea here is that in most government-funded programs, you know, the government is funding agencies to provide services for people, but this kind of flips it on its head, and the idea is to get that money directly into participants' hands so that they can decide how those dollars are spent.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that for the participant, it's aiding recovery and allowing people to remain in the community, and then for the administrators, it's hopefully saving money by reducing costly services like inpatient admission.
Yeah, so just to be clear, that it gives individuals with SMI, or the notion is to give people the power to buy the goods and services that they choose.
Right. And I think it's interesting to sort of drill down a little bit into actually how this works. So in practice, the way that they actually did this in the study was that the participant in self-directed care would work with a staff member to develop a recovery plan. That plan is going to have various goals, and then they're going to develop a budget where each of the lines of the budget is tied specifically to one of those recovery goals.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, there is kind of an oversight step where the program manager is going to approve the budget, and then the participant's working with staff to actually procure the goods and services. But if the purchases are tied to one of the goals, it could be for things that would be not traditionally included in like a government benefit package, like massage therapy, buying a cell phone or computer, buying clothes for a job interview, buying a bus pass instead of relying on like AccessoRide or something like that. So it really puts control over recovery financially into participants' hands.
Right. And I think just to echo, it's not giving a blank check.
Right.
There's a process, a support process that I think provides some accountability and help in implementing this.
Right. This study, as we mentioned, there's some preliminary like program evaluation evidence for self-directed care in this population, but this is a randomized control trial, specifically of 217 people in the public mental health system in Texas who have serious mental illness, over 18, understand English, and are eligible for this set of rehab and clinical services that generally includes case management, psychosocial rehab, peer services, residential services, crisis services, various other clinical services. So it's a benefit package that is geared towards this population. This didn't include homeless people. This study didn't include homeless people, people who are cognitively impaired, people with a history of violence.
Mm-hmm.
So they ended up randomizing 115 people in their sample to get self-directed care and 102 to get basically treatment as usual.
Yeah, the control here was care as usual.
Care as usual. Mm-hmm. And they're looking to see if there's differences between self-directed care and the control group on recovery outcomes, clinical outcomes, cost, and satisfaction. And just imagine that recovery was primarily measured through interviews using the recovery assessment scale and then a couple of other.
Yeah, so recovery was their primary outcome.
That's right. So we already talked about what the actual intervention was. Some other interesting points here are that they had a managed care organization carve out the self-directed care services. So that was the whole thing was implemented. The money was passed through a managed care organization who was doing focused particularly on this program. The budgets people get for self-directed care were $4,000, which corresponds to the average regional averages for services. They're not including inpatient, not including crisis, not including medications. That was just provided as it usually would be for both the control and the intervention group.
Yeah, and there were some other little methodologic details. Individuals were followed for 2 years. Telephone interviews were done at 12 and 24 months, which got most of the self-reported outcomes. Service utilization data were obtained from administrative records. 34% of the individuals had a diagnosis of schizophrenia, 41% had a diagnosis of major depressive disorder, and 26% had bipolar disorder.
So over time, the self-directed care group has better recovery outcomes, particularly goal orientation and personal confidence.
Right. So the total recovery score was higher in the self-directed care group. P-values and all of that.
Yeah, and they also had better self-esteem mm-hmm. and coping. So it's not just that they're also reporting their own improvements in recovery. They also had twice the odds of being employed over time and over four times the odds of being enrolled in formal education mm-hmm. over the course of the 2 years. So in terms of the money, they had lower total service costs than the control groups, but the differences weren't significant. So essentially, the programs didn't cost. It was
budget neutral.
That's right. So a few other details, though, is that the self-directed care group was more likely to have no costs in a lot of different service areas, but not for psychotherapy, where the self-directed care group had higher utilization.
Which I think is really interesting. So people chose psychotherapy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing is that a lot of people used the money to buy a non-traditional service, and they bought a wide variety of it, but the largest proportions were for transportation, communication, medical services, and then residential services as well.
Yeah, so again, so people get a sense of the scale, 21% of folks use transportation, 17% communication, 15% medical and residential, 14%. So it's not like the majority of people were using any particular service, but people altogether used a variety of different services. Yeah, there were a couple of other findings worth reporting.
Oh, definitely the satisfaction data. Mm-hmm. So 2 years, 60% of people who got self-directed care said they were very satisfied with their mental health services versus 38% in the control group.
Right. And then, again, just to balance it out, there were no differences in actual symptoms and psychiatric symptoms between the two groups, but there was a greater reported overall health in the self-directed care group, but not psychiatric symptoms.
So we sort of led this segment by saying how we were both excited about it. Why do you think this study stands out for you in terms of its potential impact and importance?
First of all, this is a rigorously conducted study. It's a randomized controlled trial, and that would be the gold standard for evidence-based practice to determine or identify evidence-based practices. So we have number one, rigor. And then number two, the rigor applied to this very exciting intervention that just supports the notion that at least that people with serious mental illnesses, when given the chance to be in charge of their care in a supported way, do better. And so I think that this has got to put self-directed care on the map in a way that it hasn't been before.
Mm-hmm. And I just, the whole, kind of from soup to nuts, the concept and the execution of the study, like you said, very impressive. But particularly, I just like the idea that you can get better outcomes for the same amount of money just by kind of listening to and empowering people, mm-hmm. that people know what they need in a way that an agency or large program might not be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's kind of the definition of a recovery-oriented stance.
I would just say this, that the process, again, is supported.
Mm-hmm.
And in some sense, interactive.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, take this checkbook and go do what you want to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's embedded, the self-directed care and the agency around purchasing is embedded in a very, very supportive context in which recovery and goals are articulated and there's a dialogue about how to get there. And just to be balanced and even-handed, the paper talked about the fact that they didn't estimate the costs of the actual administration of the program. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that, I don't know how that would tip the balance in terms of how expensive the program is. But I do want to emphasize that again, they have these managers or supporters that are helping the individual implement the model. But you're absolutely right in the sense that it brings to life a recovery-oriented approach in a way that's, I think, can be transformative. So that's it for today, the first podcast of 2019. 11 more, right, Josh?
Yep, not
our
last.
You're with it?
I'm with you.
We invite you to visit our website, ps.psychiatryonline.org, to read the articles we discussed in this episode, as well as other great research. Also, we remind you to check out something new, the Editor's Choice Topic Collection, which is available now. This is something that I put together with the Young Psychiatrist Group that is working with the journal. We have assembled collections of the best articles on particular topics each month. So the first month, the topic is going to be integrated care, and you'll be able to click and see the kind of a comprehensive summary of, say, 10 different articles that have focused on integrated care in the journal for like the last 5 to 10 years.
That is fantastic. Yeah, so, I will be using it.
Yeah. So if you have, really, it's like a little curriculum, mm-hmm. and you want to learn, you want to get updated on this particular topic. So every month we're going to have a new set of Editor's Choice available, and you can sign up and get an email that will lead you to the website that will have all these articles. It's kind of like people say, Lisa, can you do special issues on a particular topic? Well, what we can do very easily is sort of do a special online issue in which we put together all these cool articles on specific topics that you might want to learn about.
That's great. How do I get there?
So you get there, you sign up. You sign up at appi.org/ETOCS. appi.org/ETOCS. We also welcome your feedback on the podcast. Please email us at psjournal@psych.org. I'm Lisa Dixon.
I'm Josh Berzin.
Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next time. Okay. Yay!